This is the 19th of October, 1978, Santa Fe, New Mexico, and we're having a session with Bartholomew. Good morning, Master.
Good morning. I would like to start out this tape by saying that there will be a slight change, I feel, here. It is our feeling, of those that serve me, that the time has come that there be a two-way responsibility for some of this material. And what that means is that we need to have some important questions come up from the South, some questions that we can deal with. If we're going to be sending tapes down there, the feeling is definitely strongly one of needing to have some valid questioning to go on between us. So I would suggest that when you receive this tape, to my very, very dear friends, that you please get some questions from yourselves and from those in your group, and a long list, if you would, as long as possible, and get it up here. And our friends here will then formulate them, and we will work with them. I feel that until that time, we should probably not continue the tapings being sent, because I want to have this to be a two-way communication. Much of the burden is being left now on the persons here to ask questions that are considered important for all. And I think they've done that a long enough time. So I would place the responsibility now on others, that if the group down there has pertinent questions, either of a personal nature — I don't mean of their own personal life, but a personal questing question, or one that arises out of various books or texts that they've read or so on — that they send these along. And this then will be our last tape sent down until such time as we feel that there is some kind of interest in taking an active part in the questing.
Very good. We were wondering if you wanted to add to your comments on child raising.
Yes, we got into it, but then, as I said, unfortunately I had applications elsewhere. Basically, what I think was obvious from what I said was that the tenor and belief of the parents, or whoever's raising the child, is what is going to have a deep influence on the child. Now, this is not to say that all is hopeless if you live with parents who have no belief and are very crass and very unsophisticated and unknowing in their response to the divine power. There's always hope. And oftentimes, I know this isn't a very happy thought, but oftentimes a karmic responsibility is being taken care of through a special kind of an incarnative situation mm-hmm. with parents. So we have to realize that we have debts to pay on one level, if you want to look at it that way. And oftentimes this comes in the selection of particular parentage and some particular early events of our lives. Mm-hmm. So all is not lost at all. All is never lost. It's never too late to begin. And it is never too late to really begin to understand. So with that in mind, I would just like to make a few, I hope, helpful suggestions. I think it is important, the most important thing, I think, is to impress upon the children that there is, and there always will be, a God who is loving, who is supportive, who is waiting for the children to return in their hearts to the knowledge that there is a loving and supportive power awaiting. I think it's also very fair to tell the child that much of the writings that have come down from the great ones have come through in a garbled form. I think you must not hold up any particular form of writing as perfect, uh-huh. because then you put into the child's mind this dilemma. If the child, even as a young child, is in, a Christian class or a Jewish class or a Muslim or a Buddhist class, and they run into some data in the information, in the text, in this case the Bible or the Quran or whatever, that jars with their deep feeling of a loving, supportive, protective God, which you will find in all the religions, then this puts them in the fear dilemma. And the thing that we've gone into before, and I would like to say again, is that there is fear. There is tremendous fear of surrender to a God who is so capricious and so angry and so easily agitated and so unpredictable. Mm-hmm. Because the fact is that God is not unpredictable. God is utterly predictable. He is predictable. And his predictability can be predicted along the following lines. He is always loving. He is always protective. And he is always joyful. If you are feeling fear, know that you are not responding to a real impression from the divine. You are responding from an egotistical hesitancy toward that source. You are not responding toward the real source itself.
I think, Bartholomew, that part of the problem here, at least in the Christian tradition, is that in the Old and New Testaments, what perhaps would be better translated as revere or reverence of God is often translated fear.
All right, fear now that's a very excellent point and should be taken up. The fact is very clear that in the movement with the divine, one, especially when one is building a very deep communion with the divine, that you will always run into an overwhelming sort of feeling of absolute awe. Because when you really move into the feeling of that power, you will feel the incredibleness of it, the vastness, the all of that beauty is bound up in that. And so much of that transcends anything that you have experienced. So there is a feeling of awe, and that is true. But, and that could perhaps be explained in some sense to the child. But you do understand that there's this incredible need in some of these religions to keep people in order. Mm-hmm. And the way they keep you in order is through fear. And yes, unfortunately, they're defeating the very purpose that they've set out to serve. Now, understand that they didn't really set out to serve you. They set out to set up a certain line of thou shalt and shall nots, and then they amass all of this data and along the way it goes. Now, I feel the most important thing in a child is a child's need to communicate is very deep. Everyone's need to communicate is very deep. And as you get older, you deny your need, you make it other, you read, you do all kinds of things. But in a little child, if you'll notice, they want to share, they want to talk, they want to be with people.
Yes.
That is there are always exceptions, of course, but primarily this is what they want. And adults rarely have time for the deep kind of communing that a child needs. This is when I would suggest that you, as parents, would suggest a communication with God. Simply a talking, making it understood that communication is two-way. You can speak to God, but please have enough courtesy to wait and let him speak back. You see, employ them to try this, and they will do so. They will do so if they really feel that there is substance. Now, let us be very frank, too, that if you tell them this and then live your life without ever spending any time in communion with God, they will say, well, why aren't you doing it? And then what will be your response? Either it's real or it's not. Either, and this I would say to adults, either a communication with God is real or it isn't. And if it isn't, then don't bother. But if it is, then why aren't you bothering?
Right.
And then why not as a group? Quietly sitting down in the living room instead of turning on the television and watching whatever, why not a little time spent together in a room, just quietly being still? Nothing has to be said. Why not making it a sociable group activity to sit quietly in the presence of God, to ask for God to be there, to impress his wisdom on the hearts of all present? Why not? Why not? In other words, if you are embarrassed and reticent and inward about your love and approach for God, then it will not be very manifest to the child, and the child will then be struggling with how to come into this, how to bring it about. Do you see what I'm saying?
Oh, yeah.
That your life as parents, all parents' lives, is what will really dictate the outcome. Now, a lot of people on the spiritual path are isolationists. In that, I mean, they choose to go into quietude to do their meditations and so forth. And I say that's all very well, but if you have children in the house, if you have this responsibility, it is your responsibility to openly, verbally share it,
mm-hmm.
to really get it out there and verbally share it, not to come out with just the dictates of now, of using it. You see, the temptation will come. Just so often, the temptation comes to use these as manipulative tools. When you have a certain response you want from a child, and you sense, as you move into the religious field, you sense that now you have a way to get your child to behave. This can be teenagers as well as anything else. Then the temptation is great to come in with, well, God would not be pleased. Well, you don't know what God is going to be pleased about. You just don't know. And so my question is, please keep this open. Keep this an open thing. The child needs to understand that God stands ready, willing, and able to impress upon that heart right action, right thought, right everything. And you do not stand, you are not the Pope. No, you cannot stand in that relationship between God and your child unless you stand unless you're terribly clear, unless the parent is absolutely clear, then of course there's no problem. But so few of the parents are clear. In some cases, the children are much clearer than the parents. They're not as filled with incrustations. So I'm sorry, sir, I interrupted. What were you going to say?
No, I was just going to say that, of course, there's that temptation. Well, two things. The temptation to manipulate the child, just like the organized religion is trying to manipulate us.
Exactly.
And then, of course, it backfires, and then you have, a double problem. The child is not following the parent, and then the child may well be feeling guilty about somehow violating the will of God. So
yes.
It's pretty bad business.
Yes, really. Understand that this is very rampant, certainly in the Christian world today. Well, actually in the Judaic world too. There's a great deal of guilt in the Judaic tradition. In all of the traditions, really, there is guilt. And only because it's the manipulative factor. It works, you see. But as we've talked about before about guilt, it works for a certain span of time. But be assured that it doesn't work on the long term. So much of what parents do, they do because it's the expedient thing in the now.
Mm-hmm.
They're not really concerned with helping the child forever, amen. They just want their life to be easier, their parents' life. And they want the child's life to be easier, which means, usually, that they want the child to do what the parent wants them to do now.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not really concerned with building a tremendous bulwark of divine love and approach to that source that would greatly help that child.
Right.
So basically that's what I say. Now another thing that I think is very helpful, now some of you listening will find this utterly out of the question, and that is just fine. You know, as I say, you have to find your place in this. But I think there should be a holy place in a child's room. Just as there is an altar in your room, there should be a holy place for a child who is entering into this. I mean, I don't think you should go to a teenager who has never heard of this and just say, all right, I'm going to build you an altar and we're going to do this and you're going to do that. You see, granted, a teenager is pretty much on their way, and
right.
you probably have missed your chance if you haven't built some kind of an understanding in that child by now. But for the littler ones, if you don't have an altar, for example, if you are one of those families, and there are many of them who have a room set aside for prayer and meditation and for reading of the divine understanding and also for just being quiet. Many, many families have these. If you don't have one of these rooms, then I would suggest just a small altar, and the child's responsibility would be to keep it. Now, I don't mean candles because that can be dangerous, but just a little space. Incense, perhaps, if that appeals to you. Flowers, a little picture. A place in that room that will be a focus for what they're going to be doing.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see what I'm saying?
Yes.
Something simple. It doesn't need, you know, simplicity says so much. And let the child do it. You don't, you know, don't go in and get a great, huge print of a great picture of the Christ and put it there, and big flowers and very ornate and elaborate. It should be an outpouring of the child's heart And it will change as the child's outpouring changes.
Right.
There may be times when it's left fallow and nothing is happening, but then if you're being honest, you'll see that in sometimes your altars within your heart lay fallow. And the outward altar is simply a reflection, a mirror image of the altar within.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel that this kind of understanding, always building, always present, is really what ends up being meaningful. Now the question does arise, is it helpful for them to go to an organized church service, organized worship together, and get strength from that, from their peer group?
Right.
I leave that entirely in the hands of the parents. I don't feel that this is anything that can be answered in a mass situation at all. You will have to go on what you feel within. If you feel you've found a church that builds the kind of understanding that you are feeling strong with, then that's fine. You don't necessarily have to go to the church yourself if it's something that you feel that would be beneficial. If you feel that you are inadequate to the cause of helping, then look around, find something, even if it isn't quite what you would want to do, and make that a commitment for the child. But when the child turns from it and says, I don't want to go, then you're in a dilemma. If you're not going, you see, you have to be fair. And if you're not going, then is it really fair to say, I know, but I'm going to make you go. I'm not going to spend the time. I'm going to go back to bed Sunday, but you're
right.
going to have to go. No, you have to realize that you're dealing with rational beings. Children may be immature in some ways, but they're rational. They're utterly rational, and they have the ability to understand when, in your terms, a trip is being placed upon them.
Or when they're being put in a contradiction.
They understand these contradictions, and they can't make the leap across these contradictions like adults in later years just blur it out and just leap across and make connections that, from our perception, are totally irrational. You make some very irrational decisions. You can uphold two absolutely conflicting beliefs and find no conflict with that. From our perception, this is utterly, it's mad, if you want to know our real perceptions. We don't understand how you can do these things. Uphold one position on one hand and do something on the other, but that's another subject. Do you think I've covered this? Do you think that this gives the feeling?
Yes, although I wanted to ask, I just wanted to check with you on one point. There's a school of thought in psychology according to which the child, the personality at least of the child, is pretty well set by the age, before the age of seven. At what point would you say it might be too late to try to introduce ideas about relating with the divine? You indicated the teenage years. Is there any?
Well, the reason I say the teenage years is not that they cannot be absolutely taken up with and enfolded with it, but it probably won't come from their parents.
Mm-hmm.
You see, the thing you have to realize is that the reason the teenagers are difficult and why people have difficulty in the teenage years,
right,
is not because of the child. It is because of the terribly inadequate relationship that has built up between child and parent by the time they're teenagers.
Uh-huh.
It isn't that the child's growth is stunted. It's that the growth of the relationship between the parents and the child is probably by this time so encrusted with rules and regulations and contradictory dialogue and hostility and backbiting and underhanded manipulative devices on the part of parent and child, both, that the whole thing is in a sense hopeless. Do you see? The parent is no longer the source from which real wisdom is going to be gleaned, because they really aren't interested. And the reason they're not interested is great deal of it has to do with the fact that the parent has not been interested in really supporting and building the child, taking the time.
Mm-hmm.
Usually, as I said before, the parent has a different desire, which is in this tumultuous world, is to keep the child on the straight and narrow.
Mm-hmm.
I think that would be phrasing it very well, that the parent's concern is keeping the child on the straight and narrow, and anything that deviates either way is terrifying to the parent. One, because they very realistically see the disasters that could befall the teenager. That's a valid statement. But on top of it, let's be very frank, they don't really know what to do.
Yeah.
A parent doesn't really know how to take care of these things. They feel lost. They feel bobbing about on a great chaotic sea, and they can only hope that a few of their things will end up being important and not ineffectual. So all of the statement about at seven and so forth, I don't really agree with that, sir, but I do believe that out of the vast choices that a child has, that many of their selections have been temporarily made by the time they're seven. Temporarily made, because they do change. All those psychological dialogues really are not real. They reflect a truth that I would absolutely reject. There is nothing so rigid, there is nothing so encrusted that cannot be broken through and probably will be broken through at a later time. It's simply a very handy device that one psychologist can pinpoint and put on a board all of these characteristics are manifesting. But basically, I don't agree with it.
It also gives parents a good excuse to give up working on the child or
That's
working
right.
with the child.
That's right. Well, if I can't do it by the time they're seven, forget it. Fine, that gives me great rationale to forget it. So now I can just go about doing whatever it is that I want to do and too bad. But the only thing that I think that really works on anybody, I don't care if they're a child or older, is to see within that being the incredible, undying, ongoing love, beauty, wisdom, and power of the divine within them. And I think that the more you can perceive this, even if you don't perceive it, reminding yourself that it's there and reacting to that part of their being rather than the obviously deficient ego will do the very best to help anyone build a strong life of what you would hope would be virtue. You would call it virtue, and there is such a thing as virtue. But virtue is not what you think it is. It has nothing to do with all of these little movements on the earth plane. Virtue is a state of being. And all virtue means is that you have so opened your own heart to the point where you are able to hear within you the deep resounding beauty and truth of a divine power and then act accordingly. And human beings call it virtue. I just call it being in harmony with the Tao.
Mm-hmm.
A virtuous act is one that is in total harmony with God's will, which means it's totally loving. That's all. It's not very complicated. It just means it's totally loving. But to humans who are so used to having acts be good for one and not good for another, they see virtue as something that is so far out of reach, only because they don't want to reach it. You know, they're not interested in acting out any kind of total movement. They want to act out their own desires, which is what we've talked about before. So I would say don't give up on your children, because I'm not giving up on you, and nobody's giving up on anybody. We're all going to keep on. And praise God that this is so. I mean, if it were true that that you should quit on your child, then that law must go all the way up, and the greater ones should quit on the ones who have not yet come into full understanding. So no, we don't ever give up on anybody. We just keep doing our best to go within and to find the wellspring of truth and love and act upon it, that's all.
Shall we proceed with another question?
Certainly.
I wonder if you'd say a few things about the proper relationship that an aspirant should have with his or her physical body. His or her own body. What kind of attitude is appropriate? What types of things should be done?
Mm-hmm. All right, well, once again, I will be very inadequate in answering this, because there is no way to answer that question in a one-to-one situation. Certain things are helpful for one person that are not be at all helpful for another. For example, and I know this will startle and abhor some listening, St. Francis is looked upon as being a fool for his approach to his physical body. You know, he was very careless of it in the sense that he called it brother ass and so forth. I would like to say that I don't agree with that perception of St. Francis at all. That because I happen to have access to his past incarnative patterns of life, I know from the wisdom from which I can view his situation that was absolutely the most expedient device that he could have selected. All right?
Mm-hmm.
That was necessary for his coming into oneness with the Spirit. Now, that is not necessary for a lot of people. But the main problem on the Earth plane today, given this all as a preface, I will make some general remarks, and I would really appreciate it if no one will say, but Bartholomew says, and then proceed to live a life according to what I say. What I say is that I cannot answer your specific, but there are certain general trends that are true on the Earth plane today that I think really should be discussed.
Yes.
And the first one is that those on the Earth plane today are utterly dedicated, excuse me, in the Western world and parts of the rest of the world, but certainly in the Western world, are 100% dedicated to the proposition of ease and comfort. Hardship is, of the physical nature, is utterly abhorrent to the Westerner. It reflects up to them that God is unloving, and that somehow if you are not having a lot of opulence in even the middle class life today, in my perception, is opulent.
You see, well, I can see why you say that.
You see, it's a matter of my perception of how much is really necessary. And I think opulence is probably the greatest stupor-producing device
right.
on the Earth plane today. And people are very confused, and I would like to say this, that if you find your life to be boring, if you find that you are on a treadmill of having to work all the time and not having any time for either leisure, which might be your God at this time, you know, golf or tennis or reading or swimming or walking or whatever might be your form of God, if you find that you're working all the time because you have all of this edifice to support and you don't have time for other things, I would suggest to you that you sit down and look at your lifestyle, because I feel that a great deal of what you are supporting is not necessary. And you'll say to me, oh yes, but in this rising price spiral, there's nothing I can do, and so on. And I say, all right, then you stay where you are and I won't speak to you because you can't hear me. But there are people who will hear me. And then they will say, yes, but my children are accustomed to this and it would be
right.
so unfair to take it away from them, and so on. And I say, all right, then you stay where you are. You aren't going to hear me. But it goes back to the basic question. What comes first with you? Seek ye first the kingdom of God, and all else shall be added unto you. There is no statement, and there was no statement meant, that if you first seek the kingdom of God, you're going to become wealthy. I mean, there was no such meaning in that. But, you know, a lot of people interpret it that way, that if you first seek the kingdom of God, then you're going to get all of the so-called goodies added onto you. Well, it is true you will get the goodies, but they're not going to be what you expect. They're not going to be materialistic goodies. In fact, you won't even care. And that is the wonderful, wonderful saving awareness that comes with really beginning to be devoted to union with the divine, that you don't care about other things. It is immaterial to you. If you only have to eat once a day, you know, you could just eat once a day. There is no law that says you have to eat three times a day.
Mm-hmm.
You could adequately eat once a day, or you could take the food that this Western world eats once a day and spread it over three times a day, and you would do very well. There is an incredible amount of, I don't know what words to use, overindulgence, I suppose, although that's such a negative word to so many, but I feel that's a strong enough statement, that there's an overindulgence of what one is doing with the physical body. You overfeed it, you underwork it, and you pamper it a great deal. You know, all of this bathing and all of these things put upon it, and the things that go in the hair and the things that go on the face and the clothing that goes upon it, and having to have different colors for different events, and our perception is that this is such a matter of overindulgence in the mind. It is the mind. It is, you know, the body is not to be blamed. And the reason that this is done is something that I think everyone who is serious about union with the One should look into. Why am I spending so much time building a house, paying for a house that my body and the body of my family is going to live in? Why am I spending so much time paying for threads that go upon the physical frame? Why am I spending so much of my day working for money for certain substances to go into the mouth. And the underlying reason is always the same. Somehow you believe that if you pursue this, it will make you happy. That is the premise upon which the ego would have you work. I would ask you to give very serious thought to, is that a true statement? Look at your own life. Look at your own life. Look at what you have built. And then ask yourself, look at the number of hours that you and your family, you know, however many in your family are working, all of you, and add it up and assess it. Is it worth that many hours of work in order to support this edifice, to house this body? You know, it's like the grand tombs of the Egyptian pharaohs. You know, it's the same kind of thing reflected. You know, you're building edifices of a great deal of gold surrounding you. And the question is, has this made you happy? Now, if the answer is yes, if you are one of those that the answer is yes, then go on with it, by all means. I do not ever wish to take anything away from anyone that is giving them really deep, happy movement within their life. Do you understand?
Yes.
And there will be some who will respond that way, who have come from such a place of deprivation in their material life that this is important and it speaks to them, and I say, go on with it. There, those of you who really have had very severe and austere early lives, I say, go with it. Go on with it. It's fine. It does give you a feeling of goodness and support, and I approve of that. I really do support and approve that. I'm not speaking to those rare people, because they are rare. I'm speaking to the ones who have come from middle class or lower middle class. Lower middle class can still be opulent in our terms.
Okay.
The problem with poverty is that nobody likes poverty. Nobody likes not having enough to eat. Everyone feels that they have to have more than that to eat. It's a deprivation of the mind rather than a deprivation of the body.
Right.
All right? So as long as your mind thinks you're being deprived and that you're starving to death when you're eating totally adequately, you know, as long as you believe that in your mind, then your body will respond in kind. Your mind tells your body how to respond to it. Isn't it curious that somebody can starve to death in a week, and somebody else can fast for 3 weeks and no detriment is observed in the physical body at all? Now, isn't this curious? Is not this a curious phenomenon? And what is the difference? The difference is only in the mind. In the person who is fasting for 3 weeks, they're fasting for very substantial reasons. They want to increase, if they're spiritual aspirants, I'm saying, they want to increase the union with the divine. Or let's just say they're obese and overweight and they want to lose weight, and they look on this as a tool, as a device. It works. They don't die. Because the mind is saying, this is helpful.
Right.
The mind says, this is going to help you, body. And the body says, all right, fine, let's go with it. That's the difference. But in the mind of those who have not enough money, the mind says, this is not going to help you. This is negative. This makes you down. This makes you inferior. This makes you poor. This makes you deprived. You are deprived body, and there are certain rules that deprived bodies go by, and the body then moves into deprivation, and then it can indeed become ill and die. So it's not the body. It is the mind that builds the body. You realize that so many great ones have lived on almost nothing. Almost nothing. People look around for ways to simplify and save money, and they never look at that obvious thing. Do they really need all that food? Do they really need all that food? Do they really need all those clothes? Do they really need such a grand house? Do they really need such a fancy car? Do they really need such elaborate entertainment devices? No, they don't need it. And they go all their lives slaves to this ritual of giving alms and tithing to the physical body.
Mm-hmm.
It's a tithing to a physical body, and it, from our perception, it is one of the biggest wastes of time that you have on the earth plane. Now, there are some of you who work for some higher goals, but don't fool yourselves, all right? There are a lot of people who rationalize all their heavy hours of work, and they say, oh, it's because I'm doing good. You know, the job I do serves so many, and so on and so on. All right, it is possible that you hold a job that is meaningful and helps others. Lots of jobs seem to help others, but we've gone into that before. This can be a grand illusion, this seeming to help others. And if that is one of your motives, that's fine. But I think if you're being utterly honest, and if somebody said, if you could quit your job tomorrow and still have the standard of living to which you're accustomed, would you do it? And then ask yourself that question. Mm-hmm. And then ask yourself, what would I do with my time then, if you could have the standard of living to which you're accustomed? And what arises out of that answer will tell you a lot about yourself.
Right.
Do you see? I think this is a very helpful kind of questioning for any sincere aspirant. Because understand this, the only reason that why all of this is important is that any time you spend in such things takes away time that you could be spending trying to unify with the One. And it is true that you cannot work all day and work into the night and then meditate into the night too. You'll fall asleep. Mm. Not because you need the sleep, but because, again, you have told your body, the scientific world tells your body, that your body needs a certain amount of rest. This is another very false statement.
Is there any guideline?
No, this is entirely a private matter, because it has to do with your frame of mind. If your mind knows that you want the divine so badly that you're willing to stay up till 1 and 2 a night and slip in 3 or 4 hours sleep and arise the next morning, in time, you know, it won't happen right off, but in time you'll be accustomed to it. And the night hours will become joyful for you, because you're able to move with that. But of course, if you don't have to work all the time, this is very helpful, because then you can find time to rest. You know, you can come home from a day's work and take some time to really go into deep rest. Doesn't take long to deeply rest your body, a half hour. And then get up, arise, and you're ready for a new evening. Mm-hmm. But everyone is in competition on your earth plane as far as who's going to do the work. You know, there's a great deal of competition on all these levels. And we find a rare family where there's a feeling of harmony, of everybody helping each other. You designate the jobs out, and then everybody must do their job. And if one of them, if A is asked to help B out, they take it upon themselves as a tremendous violation of their free rights, because that isn't their job, and they shouldn't have to cross over and help out, in an emergency, and then they feel very righteous. But the fact is that there are too many things to do. And another reason there's so many things to do is there's the continuing need to clean these houses, these great castles of gold that you've built, and to wash up all of the paraphernalia with which you place these great offerings of food to the great God body. And you need to spend all these times washing and folding and putting away all these great clothings with which you wrap the great God body, and so on. Do you see? It goes on and on. And then, of course, there's having to read all the materials that are going to help you do better in this whatever job you have decided to serve the great God body. And it just goes on and on and on. And it's because you're seeking in the wrong place. You're seeking happiness through opulence, through serving the wrong God. And I say, if that is what you believe and what you want, then we are not talking about the same thing. But if you really have become serious about this path, I assure you, any of you, I don't care where you stand on the financial ladder, you can do with less. I don't care where you stand. Anyone listening to this tape is able to find within their life a way of simplifying to such an extent that they would be able to free up some time in order to find God. But when you don't, it simply says you're not interested. You're more interested in serving the great God body than you are in finding One. And fine, no blame. Go with it. Do whatever you wish. But please don't say, I don't have time. The fact is, you do have time, but you don't use it that way. You read the newspaper, you watch the television, you read novels, you talk to friends on and on about inane things that never come to any fruition. You go on weekends on trips, or you go out for dinner, or you, I don't care. The whole edifice, everyone look at your own life and realize that there is so much. And then there's the great trap of the real aspirant, who has given up a lot of these things that we discuss. And then how do they spend their time? Well, they read spiritual books. But realize that perhaps that is a little bit better than reading a trashy novel, all right? But actually, that isn't what we are asking. And if you've listened carefully to the tapes, you'll know that's not what we're asking. What we're asking is to put aside all the outer and start concentrating on the inner. A book is still part of the outer. And most aspirants have read every book they need to read.
Right.
I do not feel, and that very much includes anything that might come out of our work. It may spark here and there, but anybody to take up as a ritual reading books a certain time of the day, if they take a certain period of the day, let's say 15, 20 minutes, as a springboard, as a spark plug for getting things started, of course. And that often helps after a day of distraction. That often helps, yes. But that isn't what we're speaking of, and I think you know what we're speaking of. Especially these great historical novels that deal with the god. They're great fun, and they are more inspiring, perhaps, than reading a novel of another kind. But once again, even the great spiritual books, they don't really do that much. When you've gotten the basic thrust, you know full well all that remains is to do it.
Right.
And so people waste their time, and please understand, I'm not condemning it anyway. I'm just saying that it is sad for us to observe people caught in these meshes that their mind has allowed them to build, and it all goes around the body god. You know, that's all it is. It's just a need to serve the body. And then, of course, there's the sophisticated person further along who is in what we would call the health food realm, who spends the same amount of time trying to do, building this great edifice.
Body healthier and healthier.
Healthier and healthier, and taking a lot of time building and creating special dishes and this and that and so forth, and lots of time spent talking about it and so on. And all right, and there's no blame. I'm simply saying, understand that what you are seeking is the highest thing that can be sought, and it isn't going to come without a price. It is not going to come without a price. And if you can, the reason that monasteries work to some extent, and renunciation works to some extent, is that it does help you to gather up and keep focused. But the problem, of course, as we've discussed before, is that most of these deteriorate. Just as a health addict will then spend most of his time talking about health, a spiritual aspirant will usually spend a lot of their time talking about the spiritual path and not doing it. All of these things are simply devices, and the worst part with the spiritual devices used is that they create this incredible illusion that you are aspiring and that you are in making any kind of headway, any kind of progress. Because talking doesn't change anything. Doing is what changes things. And so all of this talking, although it may in some way help be supportive and so forth, one has to be very careful. All the way along, there are these traps that can take you in and deceive you for years and years and years. And you think that talking about and having groups about and meetings about and books about and so forth is somehow the doing of it, and that isn't it. An aspirant is somebody who's doing, not talking. Who's doing, not thinking. You know, you can think about things, but that's different from doing them. It's easier to think about them oftentimes. So I would just say that as far as the care of the body is concerned, I think I've said what I wanted to say, that each of you must make your own choice. Each of you must look around at your own environment and ask yourself, is it necessary? Am I really willing to put in all these hours serving this god? And do I really care if my kids mind if I stop serving this god? Will I be helping them if I continue on encouraging them to serve their god, their body god, in the same way? Or is it not more helpful for me to make it clear what I'm doing? Mm-hmm. And if they don't like it, then when they're old enough, they can leave and build their own castle and great pyramid to the great god body. They can do that. That's their right. And if that's important to them, they can do it. Now, there are certain stages in children's lives. For example, teenagers are very concerned. I do not think any of you should jump in and start reeling and riling and great hosannas against it. It's not your place. When you look at your own lives, all of you listening to this tape will know that there are areas of your life that are overindulgent, and some to a greater degree than others, and place yourself where you will. But don't tell me or anyone else, you know, when your life ends and you come to review it, it isn't going to do any good to say, but I didn't have any time. You had all the time in the world. The question is, how did you use that time? What god were you serving in your time on earth? And if you're serving the great god body, well, then that's what you realize. This is, of course, what they mean, absolutely what they mean by that passage of the Bible, that don't store up your treasure on earth, store it up in heaven. Mm-hmm. That's all they're trying to say, is how you spend your time.
Where your treasure is, your heart is also.
Well, you know this to be true, don't you? Every one of you listening to this tape knows that what you spend your time, how else can you show somebody that you care about them? All right, let's talk about that on that level. How do you show people that you love them, that you care about them? How? You think about them, and you serve them, and you want to be with them. Isn't this how you do it? Two lovers who are in love with each other. Do you really think that any human lover would believe that you really love them if you spent all of your time with somebody else away from them? Would you really think they would believe that? Or if you bought gifts but didn't give them to them but gave them to somebody else? Or if, when they could look into your mind, if they saw that you weren't thinking about them at all, you were thinking about somebody else, do you really believe that they would believe that you loved them? They would find that very unlikely. And I assure you that God finds it very unlikely too. That which you think upon, that which you tend to serve, that which you give to in thought, word, and deed, that is what you really love. So look in your own heart and don't think that God is any more deceived than a lover on the earth plane would ever be deceived. It isn't possible. And understand that as below, so above. And just as...
I have one more question which relates to this, Bartholomew, and that is, has, from a historical point of view, I'm very interested in history, is it a fairly recent development in the Western world or in the world generally for the people to be obsessed with serving the God body, or I guess there are two parts to this question, or one, has that always been the case? Or two, has it always been the case that there have been diversions, perhaps not just the body, but other things that people have become so engrossed in that they end up finding that they do not spend time seeking the divine?
Well, it's always been so, because that is the ego's main device. You see, understanding ego gives you insight into any kind of blockage that might be real in your own development. And once you understand ego and the devices of ego, then you will know that as long as someone is totally enmeshed and continues to want to be enmeshed in devices of ego to keep separate, that they will always be able to conjure out of this something to divert their mind, because that is exactly what they want to do. Mm. You see, do you ever wonder why people don't want to have nothing going on at all? Nothing. Deep silence. Why don't they want that? And you know, 99% of the earth plane doesn't want that. They want some kind of diversion. Oh, it can be very subtle and very sophisticated, no doubt, but they want a diversion. Now, why is that? Because they know full well that a part of their being is coming for them. They know that that God force, that God power is there and can move and stands as a threat to their edifice that they have built of illusion.
They being the ego nature?
The ego nature. Please realize that the ego nature is not stupid. And the ego nature is aware of the threat that is imposed by the divine power and the divine wisdom. And that is why the ego is trying so hard to keep distracted, to keep that part of your mind that is yearning. You see, there is a part of your mind that is absolutely yearning for oneness. You see, when you and another human being unite, I'm not speaking of lovers, I'm speaking of brothers. When two brothers unite, or sisters unite, the way you unite is on the mental, is what you would call the mental plane, but it's really in the realm of mind. In the sense we would call consciousness, Buddha mind, self, large self, higher mind. All right, higher mind perhaps would fit the best. I'm sorry about these words, but it's very difficult for me oftentimes to pick the one that seems appropriate, that is vast enough. Your vocabulary is not very vast.
Right.
Your vocabulary on the earth plane deals with the earth plane and the manipulations and the movements within it, which is understandable. So when it comes to things outside of that, it's difficult to find words that will match. But higher mind will perhaps do. Now, in this case, when two really begin to move into being oneness, the higher minds are what awaken to the fact that that the higher mind simply goes on and on and on and on and has no boundaries. All right, now what does that mean? The higher mind contains in it the wisdom of God. Those truths are true for everyone on the earth plane. The higher mind does not contain any specialized information. There is no specialized data available to you in the higher mind, and that is why most people don't wish to become aware of it. Because the higher mind only shows you those things that are true for you and also true for your brother. Mm-hmm. As long as you are intent upon keeping yourself better than your brother in any way at all, then you are not a candidate for knowledge from the higher mind. Because not because you're unworthy, but because you wouldn't be interested. There
right.
isn't anything in that higher mind area that you want, because what you're seeking is your separateness, not your oneness.
Right.
And the higher mind only contains the vast movements of thought that characterize and reflect the one God. And that is, there is no separation in the higher mind. Once you move into the realm of higher mind, you see yourself as one with all. And we've gone into that before. So that is not what you're seeking. But on the earth plane, know this, that there have always been diversions as long as there has been attention to the separations, which is, of course, the ego's job. And as I've said before, please don't be hard on the ego. After all, it does its job exceedingly well, and in some ways it should be really respected. I mean, it does a very fine job of what it's set out to do. And
it's very efficient.
It is, and one shouldn't, you know, be so scathing. One should have a bit of respect for this. But on the other hand, one should also decide that it is for the best of the total that all light dawn on the entire framework of what one is. And the minute that the light begins to dawn and you see reflected in everything the one light, then the ego with great joy joins. You see, the ego does at the last join. The,
uh-huh.
the thoughts that the ego is destroyed and is some ugly thing, God uses everything. God uses everything. Everything you have created, including the ego sense, God uses and transmutes into something glorious. So don't worry about that. The ego isn't something to be killed. The ego is something to be lit up with the light of the knowledge of the One. And then it too will reflect back the love of God, and the game is over. So don't be too hard. You know, just realize that the ego too will rejoice in one day when it can put down its burden of trying so hard to continue to make real an illusion. It's a very difficult job to try to make real something that is not real.
Yes.
A very difficult job. And you, all of you on the earth plane, spend your whole life trying to create reality out of an unreal phenomenon. It's very difficult because it can't win. It can't be true. So we should have compassion for that part. But in answer to your question, always, always, always are there diversities. And when the world looks like it's in terror, in jeopardy of becoming overwhelmed with the love of God, be assured something will rise up. A war is always very handy. A war always works very well. This takes everybody's mind off of anything else and places
right.
it right in the realm of oh, we've got to win and we've got to put aside all of our personal things and we've got to move out and we've got to defend ourselves and our children and our families and our land and our homes and oh my, it goes on and on. What a terrible thing to have another nation overrun us. I mean, after all, we're so right, we're so perfect, we're so true, and we're so good. Our life is so wonderful. Why would we ever want to try somebody else's kind of life? And
right.
it goes on and on. So I have no hope for you. Historically speaking, the history of the world is a record of ego's movement through time and space. And that's all that can be said about that.
Thank you very much, Bartholomew.
I feel that there is a subject that should be dealt with, which is, I don't know if you have time. Do you have time?
Sure.
I want to talk about reciprocal communion. And by that I mean, I would like to explain a little my opening statement on this tape.
Ah.
In the beginning stages, when people are seeking the light, and when they make a sincere call, and someone like myself appears in one form or another to help. The beginning stages are pretty much one person, in this case myself, doing most of the instruction, and the other person usually being passively open and receiving and taking it in. Now, there are various ways that these relationships can go. There is a time at which that relationship will end, because what is necessary is for me, in this case, to receive back from those that I'm instructing what you would call feedback, what I would call reciprocal communion. I have no way of really knowing the effectiveness of what I am saying. This is why I keep saying, do you understand? And that may seem strange to you that I don't understand, but I don't always understand, and I most assuredly don't understand about our friend's work with the group to the south.
I see.
I cannot really understand. Even if I were there, say, once in a while, I still would not understand on an ongoing day-by-day basis, what am I missing?
Yeah.
There is such a vast amount of knowledge, of God knowledge, of God help, of God wisdom available, but I feel often like I am just dipping into a pool and hoping that the water that I draw will be helpful and will quench some people's thirst. Now, understand that this would be a much more dynamic and much more creative movement if I could have more people telling me what it is they yearn to know. I have access to a great deal of data. I say that without arrogance, because it has not been because of any merit of mine that I have become available for this data. I'm simply saying it is a truth. I can help, but I cannot help any longer unless I am receiving some help on this side. There comes a time when we will have to move in a reciprocal arrangement. Instead of you just receiving, all of you will have to start giving back to me so that we can build in a relationship. Either we will have a relationship or we will not. If we're not going to have a relationship, then much of this will end. And the two of you, of course, will go on with your work, and we will deal with that and continue that on. But as far as the tapings and the work in the South and so on, this is going to have to turn into some kind of a reciprocal arrangement, or I'm afraid it's not going to be effective anymore. You see, now is the time for you to show me whether what I have said has hit or missed, whether it has changed anything within you. If so, what is the next step? What is the stages? Where are you? I don't have to be down there. You know, the woman doesn't have to travel down there. I am available. And don't have to worry about intermediaries. If it's something that you want to send in the mail, do so. I'm stating very frankly that the stage in our relationship has come where reciprocal understanding is necessary. I need to understand what is going on in your hearts and minds. And the only way I can know that is for you to tell me. I am not going to go down and invade your privacy. I simply need to know. I also would say that let us not deal with personal problems in the sense of what should I do and this and that, unless it's so overwhelming. That is not my function, as I've said before. There are many excellent, absolutely excellent psychics at work on the earth plane today that can do that. This is not psychic work, and I do not wish to move into that area. But if you have a question of spiritual understanding that you think I have access to data that would be helpful, then now is the time to bring it forward. Because if we do not build a growing relationship, then it will not be a relationship, and I would choose to end it, because I cannot continue to take time to feed into data, into people who I can't really build a relationship with. The hope is that through me you will begin to build your relationship with the divine within you. And you know, if any of you listening to me have faith in me as a translator of the divine wisdom, you can, in the quiet of your own mind, call on me for answers. I am not only available through the woman, you know. I am available because I am available. I am available because I share in the vast wisdom. And if you care to, you can always ask me, and I will do everything I can to answer that. And the beginning process of that might be simply to start asking me on the earth plane, you know, through the method of the woman. For those of you who don't wish to have your things in a public nature, there's no reason in the world why you can't begin to reach out. And if you can't use me, if that is not very advantageous for you, then use another figure. Use something. Or if you even don't like figures, then use the power of God. But use something to answer your questing. I hope I've made this clear, and I hope you all understand with what love I hold you. I hold you in great love and great, great respect and great caring. But there comes a time in every relationship. Just as in a lover relationship, one cannot always be doing the giving. The other needs to, for their own growth, move into that relationship and begin giving back, sharing. The sharing of our relationship is what is going to make it meaningful. As long as you stand passively outside and want to have things given to you and are not willing to give in return, in this case simply giving in helpful questioning, then I'm afraid the relationship will have no real meaning to you other than a once a week or twice a week. Let me put it this way. The God I serve is not content with capricious love affairs. And either we are going to commit, and that means that we will continue to be communal in our love and our sharing, or we won't. And I hope I've made this clear. Do you think I have?
I believe you have, yes.
Fine. So I will then, this will be the last tape that we'll send south until we hear something. This is not a threat and should not be taken as such. It's simply that if there is no bona fide, genuine questing from that group, then really our job is done. And it may be that the job is done. It may be that it is finished. It may be that I have given sufficient data that those groups can simply take it and move and work with it and absolutely go on. And if that is so, that's wonderful, and that's all I need to know. I simply need to know where we stand in our relationship. And if you feel, all of you down there, that everything is sufficient unto the day, if you feel that the data given is enough to keep you going on, then I say that's fine. Let's put a hold on these tapes, and in a few months or in a year or whenever, if you feel a renewed need, then fine. Let me know and we'll begin. Or maybe we should just cut down the tapes to once a month or whatever. But I need to understand. I need to understand where you are, and I need some response from you. So, with that, I will close, and good morning.
Thank you, Bartholomew.